Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, indeed, we need to get started. We have a part one of part two right before us. And our guest this evening is Sunshine, a Star. So sit back and relax, because we've got a really great program going on, and make sure you check out part number two. Stay tuned.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Let's take this walk together as we journey with Sunshine a Star, who is my guest for this evening. She will be having two segments with us, part one and part two. Let's get to know her just a little bit here. She is a clairvoyant. She was born into a psychically gifted family. Sunshine, aptly named by her hippie parents, began her psychic and paranormal training at the tender age of 2 years old. Sunshine's parents encouraged her psychic and spiritual growth, which always came in handy, especially when objects in the house were a bit misplaced. As a child, she was taught to read and interpret the energies around herself and her family by using a biofeedback method and other techniques. Healing gifts came about at her age of 13 while in a Methodist church, in which laying of the hands was a special part of each Sunday morning's program. At the age of 22, she discovered the Reiki healing method, which gave her a chance to work with healing gifts without feeling the client's pain. At the age of 35, Sunshine was employed by Belcor's Common Language Project, a software system that she used her clairvoyant abilities to hack and report bugs to software engineers. This was part of her main source of income. However, also at the age of 35, she would have a traumatic and terrible incident in which she met Master Cho Kok Su in his spirit form. He is the founder of the modern pranic healing and arthrotic yoga. Sunshine is a clairvoyant psychic medium with over 30 years of experience working in the field. She has done paranormal investigation, exorcisms, location of missing persons, objects, or pets. She is a yoga guide, a metaphysical teacher. She has guided individuals in imagery meditations, past life readings and regressions. She is a subject matter expert also in the following areas, such as tarot, crystal ball scrying, spirit communication, tea leaf readings, and aura readings. She has also delved into Wiccan magic. As a pranic healer and psychic surgeon, she specializes in pain management, torn ligaments, and the repair of broken hearts. On the side, Sunshine likes to do a little acting. She's a model, and she is also the adoptive parent of a horse named Rocco. And there is so much more. So please welcome my guest, Sunshine Astar. Well, hello, Sunshine, and thank you so very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Oh, we have a very extensive program in this very fast hour, and I want to make sure that we get in everything we possibly can. And so I'm just going to jump right on in here, and we're going to just get started. So, Sunshine, very interesting name. I thought maybe we would go back a little bit to your humble beginnings, because everything kind of starts and evolves for maybe a reason, and maybe you can help us grow into where you're at now just by starting us from the start there. So take it away, Sunshine.
Absolutely. So my name is actually my real name on my birth certificate. People always think that I've made this name up for the job that I do, or that I'm trying to be kind of Hollywood, but it just naturally, occurred. My parents are, when I was born, they are hippies from the Flower Child generation. And they picked out the name for me because they felt it would open doors for me, that it was a lucky name, that I was a lucky child. And I do feel that I am a lucky person, and I was a lucky child because I was born into a family that already had a psychic lineage. And so when at age 2, I started to hold my arms up into the air for my grandfather who passed away to pick me up. And my mother right away knew, okay, she's got it. We're going to work with it. So it was pretty much predicted in my birth chart that I was a very psychic person. I was also born in the call, which is when you're born inside of the birth sac. And so all of the things that, in my beginnings really kind of set me up for this kind of life. And just like if you were born into a family of lawyers or doctors and your parents wanted you to be a lawyer or a doctor, this was my life. And it's good in a lot of ways, because most people that I've met who are psychic had a lot of their parents' disapproval, or disapproval of the church, or this is not from God. And I didn't have any of that. I was free to explore. I was free to tell my parents what I was seeing, and they were always interested. They helped me with my gifts. They helped me learn to control them and to work with my guides. And I'm very, very thankful that I had that kind of upbringing, because I'm very free and fluid in my gifts. And I think that my childhood really provided that for me.
That's interesting. I have a question for you regarding, let's go back a little bit to your parents, and then I want to go back to your grandparents. Okay, so regarding your parents, were they really active at that time? And, Sunshine's younger than myself. And so I know that as time progressed, maybe things were coming out a little bit more in time regarding going to a psychic, talking to a psychic and all that. But how was life for your parents? Let's start with them. Were they practicing helping people with their psychic abilities? Was it just your mother? Was it both your mother and father? Explain that a little bit to us.
Sure, no problem. Well, no is the short answer. Neither one of them use their gifts the way that I do. They are both psychic, both very psychic. My father is very in touch with the angelic realms. He's always been excited about paranormal events, or if there's a ghost in the house. And my mother, that's really where the documented psychic lineage comes from on my mother's side, mm-hmm. because we do have a gift in the family that's passed down from youngest daughter to youngest daughter. I am the oldest child, but I'm the only girl. So I got the heavy dose of the psychic abilities. So my mother used her abilities mostly with friends, family. She just knows things, but it wasn't necessarily what she was doing for a job. She's a writer, and my father and her at the time were antique dealers. So, you know, we had a lot of haunted objects that would come into the house, a lot of interesting characters that would come to purchase the antiques. And my mom really had an uncanny knack for knowing exactly what objects somebody would be interested in. So she kind of used her gifts throughout her life. It was just when they did my birth chart that it was pretty much obvious that I wasn't going to be good at much else, maybe. And so my whole life, I've always been told, this is what you do for a job. This is what you're going to do. You can do this, or you could be a painter, either one, but probably not much else, sunshine. And so that was sort of what I grew up hearing, learning, part of my story. And so I pretty much always knew I was going to be doing this. There was a really short time, as all teenagers go through, right? A little rebellion. Yeah. And it's really, really difficult to rebel against a hippie because they're already rebellious. Yeah. I rebelled at about age 18, where I said, no, I'm not going to do that for my job. I'm going to be an art history person. I'm going to learn about art history, and that's going to be a great academic job for me. Mm-hmm. And I got a scholarship, went to Hunter College in New York. I lasted only one semester before I was like, no, this is really boring. What am I going to actually do with this? My parents are right. And I immediately got back into it. So I only had about 2.5 years of rebellion until I realized I can't really run from my destiny. No one can. I really can't run from my gifts. It's impossible. So every time I would try to be, quote, normal, something would happen that would immediately let everyone around me know that I was a little different than them. So it's impossible for me to kind of fit into a mold of a regular 9-to-5 job. I have tried it, but it doesn't work.
Well, we all have various gifts. Some of our gifts haven't awakened yet, or some of them are just being explored in at different phases in our life. I can tell you that I didn't know a stitch when I was growing up about what I ever wanted to be or where I was going to be directed to, and things just kind of fell into my lap as time went along. But now that I'm retired and everything, I couldn't have told you years ago that I would be having a successful podcast. And I couldn't even tell you years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing right now, which is a TV talk show on a subscription network that is really attempting to advance itself to a greater level and everything. And so I feel like I'm part of all of that. But that brings up another question I have for you, because I want to go back a little bit. Did you say that your parents owned an antique store?
Yes. Yes. Okay. When I was a little kid, when I was just born, they owned an antique store in Chester, New Jersey. They were one of the first people to open up a shop on Main Street there. And it was called the Splinter Shop. And the tagline for it was Granny was cool. So we lived above the antique store, and it was a big old haunted mill that wasn't developed yet at that time.
Cool.
And there were several spirits that lived there. We had a very helpful spirit who would open the door if you had your arms full of groceries. My mother could tell so many stories about it. My father as well. My father actually encountered a being at one point hovering over my bassinet, and it didn't look super friendly. Mm-hmm. But once he kind of sat with the entity, he realized that this was a very strong guardian of mine, and it was nothing to be afraid of, that it kind of came in with me. And some clairvoyant people can see my spirit guide, and they're often a little nervous about it, but it's just a very fierce protector. And being that my parents taught me at a very early age to communicate with ghosts and spirits, it's really kind of it's kind of an entity that belongs in the world of death, but helps me to straddle both worlds.
So I want to go further on that a little bit more. I think people are very fascinated by, I want to jump into the antique thing back again, and then I want to go forward about your gifts, okay? And mm-hmm. and where these all, what was like the first thing that you noticed of yourself when you were, predicting something, seeing something or whatever. But I want to jump back just for a moment to kind of finish up this antique segment a little bit. So people say all the time, this object, it's haunted, or there's, I don't know what it is about this object, but everything is terrible, or something bad is always happening when we brought this home, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think? What do you think this is? Do you think it's the energy of somebody on an object? Do you think the object has a life of its can have a life of its own, because I have people going in that direction once in a while. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Because you've been around these antiques, and these antiques have been in the hands of some people who are territorial, some people who just loved what it is, and they're not willing to let it go, and so they're hanging onto it. What was your experiences like? And can you give an example, if you can recall, of something that happened while you might have been in the antique store with your parents, where an antique was essentially at fault of the situation?
Yes, it's actually kind of hard to narrow down how many experiences I've had like that. When someone owns something that they love, that they touch every day, for example, Victorian times, maybe a hairbrush and mirror. Right. Mm-hmm. That we don't have these kind of objects anymore that we set in a vanity and they're, covered with abalone, or, they're very beautiful objects that maybe a lady sat every night brushing her long, long hair that had been pinned up all day. I have found a lot of personal objects that people have owned. Their energy is still on them. So I could hold an object and I could tell you all about the person that used to use it. And then there's another thing that kind of happens, which is unfortunate, where a lot of times my father, he had would go into houses and clean out a house for someone after they had passed away. Maybe the family just didn't want to go through it, or, they took what they needed and the rest they wanted to kind of get rid of. And so my father would do these clean outs where then we would get objects that literally were from someone who just passed away. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that as I would walk through the store, I would see people standing next to their old dresser, or actually sitting, trying to comb their hair. Moving objects around the store was constant. So you have these objects that people didn't really want sold, and they're kind of upset about it. So they try to stay with their object, whether it's a dresser. And that's like the most common one that I've noticed is vanities, from vanities from the 20s, 30s, 40s that really women used every day. Like, we don't do that. Some people do, but most people don't anymore. I found a lot of people that were attached to clothing, to vintage clothing that they wore, to maybe it's a very special bowl that they used in the kitchen. The temptation there always for me is that I can hear the spirit who wants me to take care of their object, right? So how do I just not become a hoarder is my issue, right?
Right.
I go through and I'm like, this set of keys feels really special. I feel like I should bring it home. So sometimes my parents would have issues when I would literally be like, well, I took that back to my bedroom because the ghost lady told me I was supposed to put it on my dresser. you know, so sometimes I would get into a little bit of trouble for taking things from the shop and putting them in my room. But what really goes on is that we do have free will here, you know, even in death. When it comes time for the light and you to go to the other side, you can still choose that you don't want to go. Mm. If you have unfinished business, if you feel you can't leave your house, you know, whatever it is, you will not decide to go into heaven. And so that creates an actual ghost. A spirit is someone who's gone to heaven and gotten permission to go back and forth to actually help their family or to guide their objects after death, whatever it is. But as a ghost, the person is literally kind of stuck. Yep. And can't really affect too much. So it's always been my experience that when a ghost is angry, they will act up and move things about, break things, stuff like that. And as soon as you begin to talk to them, as soon as I begin to talk to them, they sort of calm down because they realize they're being heard and seen. So sometimes I could promise a ghost that I would take care of their object and make sure it got into good hands. And then as a little tiny medium, I could send that ghost to the light and it would make the antique store a little calmer.
What are your thoughts on, I should jump, this is a good part about the calming part. Saging items, saging yourself, saging your home. What are your thoughts about that? Because, you know, you need to open up a window because that stuff is pretty, can be pretty intense. And what do you, some people say that the sage, from what things have been described or shown on television once in a while, people are under the possible misunderstanding that sage kind of chokes out the energy and you open the window up and then it you can choke it out, the get it out of the window. That's one idea. The other idea is that other people have talked about, no, this stuff is really intended to just kind of calm down the negative or the hostile energy. What are your thoughts about sage?
Okay, cool. Well, sage is it's a sacred herb and it definitely has cleansing properties. There's plenty of other types of things you can burn as well, like Palo Santo, you know, or some cedar, whatever, or mugwort, whatever you feel is going to calm down the spirit the most. I do like to use white sage when I'm clearing a house or clearing an object. I do the open window technique that you spoke of, but I do a lot more than just the sage for that. Especially if I'm in a haunted house clearing out a negative entity, I will use a whole procedure that kind of mixes some things from Catholicism, some things from what my parents taught me. But I will go from the top of the house with sage in every corner, drawing certain symbols, bringing and pushing, as you said, squeezing exactly that energy out through the open window, having, you know, an angel on the other side of the window opening up that tunnel for everybody to go like a conga line if it's a really infested place. But generally, if you're being bothered by a ghost in your home or office or anywhere, you can light some sage to kind of lighten up the energy, but it's not going to make them go away 100% unless you actually do the clearing. Mm-hmm. So when I have, when I get an object from an antique store now or from the Goodwill or something like that, if it doesn't feel nice to me right away, I will sage it and I'll kind of leave it out under the moonlight and then I'll let it charge up with good energy or take it to the beach. I also like to use salt, not to throw at anybody, not to throw at any entities, because honestly, they don't like that. Mm-hmm. People say, well, I'll just throw salt at it. And I'm like, okay, good luck with that. Yeah. Because the salt tends to make them angrier. So sometimes when you're working with whatever energy you're working with, you sort of need to know what is its culture? Where did it come from? What does it want? Why is it here? And then you can adjust what you're doing in order to take it to where it needs to go, AKA the light, or to just literally get out of your house if it doesn't want to go to the light, right? Mm-hmm. So I use a lot of different techniques, but it really, sage will help to lighten up the energy, but not necessarily make it go away 100%. I will use sage to cleanse my objects. I use Palo Santo as well. In fact, I've really kind of been getting a lot more into Palo Santo for my everyday cleansing for myself after I'm done with my work every day, or even in between clients, I will cleanse myself. I don't like to use sage for that. I like to use sage for my special occasions, for my really haunted houses, or my really haunted objects that really, you know, need that level of cleansing.
Interesting. I want to jump back a moment. Thank you on that, because I think that that explanation will help a lot of people understand the purpose of sage and how it's really used, and that the fact that not always will you be successful in getting out of the house. It can come back. And so for whatever reason, it can come back. But I want to go back to when you were younger, and I want to ask the question of, do you remember the very first time that you were startled or nervous or scared of something that either came to you, was in you sitting in your room, attempted to scare you, or anything like that? Because, you know, we all have that first, for all of us that are sensitive, or we've had experiences with the paranormal or something, if we want to identify it as paranormal, there's always that one first moment that people recall. Do you recall yours?
Well, I'm very different than most people, I think. So I do remember being a little child. I remember being a baby. I even remember my own birth, which is, you know, so I do remember my grandfather, when I was about 2 years old, passed away on my mother's side. And I had called him Baba. That was my name for him. Mm-hmm. And after he passed away, I saw him in our house just doing his normal stuff. And I would raise up my arms and ask him to pick me up. I didn't understand why he wasn't picking me up. Mm-hmm. So I would raise my arms for him to pick me up. He would not pick me up. And I would throw a total tantrum on the floor. You know, terrible twos, that was me, just on the floor crying because I didn't understand why he couldn't hold me. So that was my first encounter with a spirit. And it was my mother's first encounter with seeing that I was actually fulfilling what the birth chart said, and that I would be able to carry on, you know, our psychic line pretty well, because I'd already started at age two. Another thing that happened around that time was that I started speaking French, and no one really knew why. I walked to 18 months, and I was walking and talking and speaking French. And then I was taught English. So French kind of came in with me, I think, from a past life. Mm-hmm. I don't speak French fluently now at all. As I didn't practice, I didn't keep it up, and no one was speaking it to me all the time. I can tell you that the first time I was actually frightened out of my mind, I was a little bit older. So I had been seeing spirits, ghosts, entities my whole life, and nothing really frightened me, to be honest, because I had such an open relationship with my family. That, you know, if I saw something that was scary, quote scary, or looked scary, it was usually an entity that was in pain that needed help. So my experience with scary stuff has always been like, okay, let's look past the scary part and see what's really happening. Mm-hmm. But when I was around, I think I was about 22. Mm-hmm. And I had been working with a person who was teaching me how to clear energies from haunted places. And we'd had a call to go to a place where the gentleman of the house was being scratched. Mm-hmm. And up until that time, up until age 22, I had never encountered an entity that could hurt someone. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when I got the phone call, I was literally like, okay, I don't believe you. First of all, I'm like, what do they want from me? Because obviously ghosts can't hurt people. They don't hurt people. Mm-hmm. And this was my first experience with something that was that upset that it could make scratches and bruises. Mm-hmm. Since I was age 22, I've had lots more experience with entities like that. And it doesn't really make me nervous anymore. But that particular time made me very, very nervous. I was going to meet a couple in their home and see if I could find out what was doing this to them. I had been working with a priest, mm-hmm. and that priest, I guess, decided that that day was the day he was going to cut me loose and let me do it myself. So I went to the home, and first of all, remember, I was skeptical. I was like, yeah, yeah, let's see these scratches. I don't really believe you. Right. So I was going through the house first, talking to the people that owned the home. It was an old Victorian, also in Chester, New Jersey. And it was a very haunted town. It's built on a copper mine. I think it kind of creates an energy in which ghosts like to live. Yeah. And very kinetic. And I went through the home and I said, I'm not finding it. I don't find anything really too negative here. Let's just sit here in your living room. And I had the gentleman take off his shirt. I said, first, let me look at you. Let me look all over at you. I don't see scratches. Let's just sit here and wait for a moment because I'm not really hearing or seeing the ghost. Yeah. It was about 10 minutes that we sat, mm-hmm. and he went, oh my God, ah, like screamed. Yeah. And there were the scratches right before my very eyes. Now, mind you, I'm supposed to be the professional mm-hmm. in this moment. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to run out of the door. I was like, ah, oh my God, what just happened here? What am I dealing with? I wanted to run. But instead I said, okay, I can see that. Yes, you definitely have something going on. And then I said, may I use your phone? Mm. And I called my friend that I had been working with. And I said, can you help me? Can you help me, Father Jay? I need help. Mm-hmm. You need to come over here immediately because it's not just a regular ghost. It's something that's making scratches. And he had an Irish accent and he was like, oh, lassie, you just do what I've taught you and it's going to be fine. I'm three sheets to the wind at this point. I'm not coming over. And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. So I said, all right, I'll just do what he taught me. I'll do exactly what he taught me. Mm-hmm. And I did. Mm-hmm. And when I went to go up to the second floor of the home, mm-hmm. there at the top of the steps was a very, very angry little Victorian girl. And she hated men in particular. The lady was fine, but the man was not fine. She had been abused. She had been murdered. She did not like men at all. So the lady was fine to be in the house. Nothing was happening to her. And of course, this was a relationship that was actually a good one. It was not abusive. The man had done nothing wrong. He was just simply a man in the house, yep. the only man in the house. Mm-hmm. So she chose to try to attack him mm-hmm. so that she could maybe be alone with the lady of the house and have a mother back, you know, in her life.
Right.
So I did the procedure and she did not really want to leave. But she did go with the help of Archangel Michael. Okay. She went to the light. But I will say that one went kicking and screaming because she did not want to leave that house. So that was when I was scared for the first time. And then everything after that has been pretty tame compared. I've encountered lots of entities that scratch or bruise or harm. There was one time where I was trying to remotely work on a house that was haunted because the lady of the house didn't necessarily want to tell her husband I was going to come and do this. Mm-hmm. And I was remotely doing it, and I actually got a black eye. I got punched in the eye by the entity that was in a whole different state, mostly because I failed to create my circle of salt. I just thought, I'm just going to do a little work. It's going to be fine. Again, underestimating the entity. Yeah. So what do I do now? I never underestimate the entity, no matter how benign it seems it might be or how much I think I can do. There's always a surprise. Always, Kelly. Always.
Would you say that what you encountered? I've had several hundred plus different types of experiences. I'm just thinking right now when you're talking about this. You're bringing me right back again to the one place where I captured in a screened window, not a plate window, a screen window. A little girl and an older man that the little girl, I believe, was my great aunt who died at the age of 10, about a mile and a half to 2 miles down the road. The older man could have been her doctor, who was just devastated when she died back in the day, or my great grandfather. And so I never doubted at first. Here's what a lot of people think. And you bring up a good point. And this is what I thought. Okay, so I in 2007, I captured this image. I'd always wanted to see a ghost on my great-grandfather's and grandparents, because it passed down from generation property. And so I got my wish several years later when I dreamt this or wished this at the age of 14 a few times. Okay, so then it happens. And I didn't notice it at first until I had my film developed, all right? Then I noticed, and my sister noticed this too. She pointed it out to me that there was two people in the window, not one. And then I thought, this is where I learned I was telepathic, because I could hear messages coming from them to me, and everything started to, go from there. But I had a great fascination then at that point with, of course, ghost searching, hunting, however you want to say it, and also that property. I couldn't wait to always get back on that property, because if they showed to me once, I figured they'd show it to me again. But there came a point, probably in the last year or two, which I don't want to believe. I don't want to believe that these were tricksters and trying to get me back to that property, because I had some negative things occur and attacked on that property. It was a farm property with a barn and a house that was over 100 plus years old that was built back in the day. But, you know, the thing, you bring up a good point. It's like, I always kept saying to my family members, they're not going to hurt me. I'm family. I mean, whoever these, I want to capitalize on that for a moment, because here it is. It's a generational family property built back in the, like, I think it was 1901 to 1904, under conditions of whatever. It's a beautiful property. They're not going to hurt me. I mean, my God, they should know I'm flesh and blood. They showed to me in the window. To this day, I still believe with my heart that they were who I thought they were, my great aunt and my great grandfather and or this doctor. But it surely wakes a person up when they want to start to assume that nothing is going to hurt you, because you're family, flesh and blood. You don't know if they're tricksters. You don't know what's luring you back, because it wasn't always positive, the types of experiences I had on that property, which told me that it was either someone else acting up or whatever. What are your thoughts about people getting a little bit too comfortable with thinking that they're not going to be hurt by something that they believe is related to themselves? What are your thoughts?
Oh, it's really, I'm going to give you an interesting analogy, right?
Yeah.
So say you captured a wild animal as a child and you brought it into your home. It's a little tiny cute bobcat.
Right.
and it's adorable. You first met it and it's small and cute and it's not going to hurt you. You know, it's so sweet and it knows that I'm feeding it. So, oh, I love it. Right. Then the bobcat grows up and it's not happy being in the house.
Right.
It wants more from you. It wants freedom. It wants also food. And then it has its own agenda as well. So that definitely was your family members. However, over time, something that comes in as a pet or is cute, especially in the paranormal world, especially with ghosts and spirits, they can get confused. Their agenda can be, oh, you like me, so I'm going to try to get in you now. Right. I want to live too.
Right.
Okay. So even if it's a friendly spirit or a friendly ghost, sometimes eventually they want to go to the light. They're confused. They're lost. Right. So yes, you know, things can change. Ghosts don't just like us, our emotions change, our ideas change. And ghosts and spirits are intelligent entities that are sentient. So once you saw them, they're like, hi, we're here. And you're like, oh, good. I want to come play. Yeah. And you can do that to an extent. You can do that for a long time. But eventually they're going to want something more from you, or unless they become, and you adopt them into your spirit guide world. You say, okay, dead great-grandfather, mm-hmm. I see you there in the window, mm-hmm. and I would like you now to become one of my spirit guides. Then things are a little nicer, and you have a better relationship. But if it's just your great-grandfather knocking about in the old house and on the property, then eventually he's going to want some relief from his state. A lot of times ghosts don't actually know that they're dead.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to interact with you as if you were there living with you, just like my dead grandfather was literally sitting in his chair at the sink, smoking a cigarette, you know, and eventually he needed to go to the light. He couldn't stay with us.
Here's another question I have regarding all this, because I think people wonder. So the property, the house became in disarray after my grandmother who lived there had passed away, and it sat pretty much idle for about 12 years. And it was a wonderful opportunity to run around on it and go search and all that sort of thing to see if there's anything existing on there. Oh, there's a variety of interesting things that I captured or experienced there. But then once the house gets burned down, and I was wondering what your thoughts are about this, the house was burned down and the barn had to come down. I mean, they couldn't be saved. Let's put it to you this way. Mm-hmm. And so now we have, the property was sold and it's in a neighbor's hands. And I know that would upset my father, who passed away about 6-7 years ago, very, very, very much. Okay. And I know that he wanted to live, and I know that he wanted to remain, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here we have a property now that's in the hands of somebody else. The barn and the house are gone. There is a shed that's still there, because if they wanted to build on there, I believe they needed to have something for building rights. It's a quirky kind of thing that I don't understand. And so here sits idols, and I go by there as other family members, and we just kind of look right out there as if nothing had ever been torn down. And it's kind of a grieving process thing. So when things are torn down, that's my question. When things are burned down, when things are not there and they cease to exist, and you know you captured a lot of haunted kind of things going on within the house and also within the barn, where does this stuff go? People ask me this all the time. Do they remain there where the house used to be, where the barn used to be? Do they say, it's not here anymore, I don't see anything here, and they leave and go back to the cemetery? What are your thoughts about haunted buildings that have then been torn down? What's your thoughts?
That's such a good question, Kelly, actually. Such a good question, because sometimes people think that's the answer. I'm going to burn down this house, and there's not going to be any more hauntings. We'll build a new house in its place and it's going to be fine. The answer is that the ghosts usually still will remain on the land.
Yeah. Mm.
And depending on how sentient they are, for example, your father who passed away, right? Mm. He might be kind of angry about the fact that the house is gone. Mm. And he may, if he's a ghost and not a spirit, meaning he decided not to go to the light, but I feel that your father did go to the light. I can sense that there's a factor where he knew he needed to go there, wanted to go there, mm-hmm. and probably was just visiting you guys in the, you know, the family home, or, you know, stopping by to say hi, making a sign to let you know he's okay. But if he's a ghost, he's most likely haunting your neighbor's house now, you know, trying to get them to rebuild, or trying to give the idea that, hey, you know, this would be a good place to put a double wide. And then another family could live there. So usually what they wanted in life, they still want in death. Hmm. And burning down or destroying destroying a home or a building does not take the ghost away at all. In fact, there's a place called Norwich State Hospital in Connecticut, in which it's a super haunted area. They are in the process of taking down buildings. And I think they want to put something like a play park there. I don't know if you've noticed this, but a lot of times when there's an asylum that's burned down or they're destroying it in order to make something else, a lot of times they turn it into a park,
right,
or children's playground. Mm-hmm. There's another place in Connecticut where we had a really big circus fire. Mm-hmm. And when I went to investigate that location, there is a school for children right on the location. And the school itself has everybody who works there, the school itself has a lot of haunted stories about it, because no, they don't go anywhere. They stay where they stay where the tragedy happened, or where they would like to be.
Yeah.
So that energy doesn't really dissipate. What you can do is kind of try to make the ghost happy in some form, like by giving an offering or asking. I usually use Archangel Michael to send anybody that's lost to the light. I like to do it as a service when I go into a haunted location, or even if I'm going through a graveyard, if I see that there's someone who's kind of like, I'm lost, I don't know where I am, I don't have a map. It's like, do you want to go to the light? Would you like to see your family again? That's always my biggest question. Do you want to see your family again? Because they are not here with you anymore. And then I'll send them to the light. Some ghosts like to haunt their grave site. I think that has to do with the modern funeral process, where they see their family and friends for the last time at their grave site, and then get a little stuck. Like, I don't know what I should do. So I do see a lot of times ghosts in graveyards that are looking for their family. And that's always what they tell me. I'm looking for my family. I'm looking for my children. Have you seen my mother? There's one graveyard in Mystic, Connecticut, where there were four children who passed away in a tugboat accident where they drowned. And when I first saw them as ghosts, they appeared to me like really kind of spooky looking. They were covered in mud. Their hair was wet. It was raining at the time that I was in the graveyard. So I was just like, what are those kids doing over there? And then as I got closer, they came closer to me. We kind of met in the middle and they were like, are you our mother? Can you be our mother? And I said, I can't be your mother, but I can take you to where your mother is. And they were nervous. They didn't necessarily want to try that yet. And so I was like, but you can hang out with me until you're ready to go. And then I walked home, and my own child, who is very psychic, said, why did you bring home these drowned kids?
Oh, God.
And I said, well, they needed a mom. And so we're going to just host them for a couple of days and then see if they're ready to go to the light. And it was really interesting because we did have some, I would call it ectoplasmic experiences mm-hmm. with them, yeah. where there was a handprint, like a wet handprint on our wall, or little bare feet walking, and you could see the feet walking that were wet. It was pretty wild. And eventually, after 2 days, they were ready to go to the light to be with their real mommy. And so I did that.
Wow. That's brave, Sunshine. But then on the other hand, I would say you're professional at what you do. So I had almost an entire segment on I've haunted 3 homes, I believe, or had attachments, and they've came back with me, but then they all turned a little bit ugly, you know, and stuff yeah. like that. And that's very brave, because I'm sitting here going, don't ever haunt your own home if you can't help it, because I'll tell you, it all started out like, I don't know if you remember this at all. There used to be a TV show called The Ghost and Mrs. Muir or something like that. And I said,
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yes. And I said to my husband, I said, oh my God, we have an actual ghost in our house. And it was friendly to me at the time. It was because I could pick up words from it from a device I had, and it was very on target with things that I was doing and very complimentary. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, this is a friendly ghost, to my husband. I said, yeah. We live with a friendly ghost. And then all of a sudden, that friendly ghost, I don't know if it was the ghost or if it's something that it attracted in there as well, or if it left. But I woke up about 3 days in a row choking to death, being choked by something. And then this hag yelling in my and screaming in my ear. And I could go on and on and on. And that's the point where I said, I'm done. And we left, but we went to another house where, once again, just like you mentioned before with the copper, very mm-hmm. much quartz and very much limestone, very much mm-hmm. a conductor of all these sorts of things. And I attracted over to this house the deceased that happened back in the Civil War days from across the road, which, by the way, it's not like they didn't give me forewarning, because they told me about themselves on my word device. And I couldn't figure it out at first, and then it all came clear. And then so I'm in my third house now that is haunted. Well, I would say I've got activity going on in here. I had a poltergeist and all that, blah, blah, blah. But mm-hmm. it's been very calm lately, because I've been very into what I've been doing. But enough of that. I want to ask you a couple questions, because I don't want to run out of time here yet with you. And I know we're getting close. Did you say in your intro to me that you had a near-death experience? And would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Yes, I had a near-death experience at age 35. Mm. And I was going into a woodshed to get some firewood to make a little fire in my fireplace. It was March 20th, 2007. And I, it's a little hard to talk about, but I am going to get through it. I went into the woodshed yeah. and I took some wood from the back of the woodshed. I'd always been a little nervous to go all the way into it. Mm-hmm. And so I would usually pull sticks out from, you know, the front of it. But obviously you can't do that forever. You have to go in eventually, right? To get something from the back, because you're out of wood that's, you know, in the front. Mm-hmm. So I went in and I pulled one stick of wood out, and I literally said, uh-oh. Mm. And I felt a big crash on my head. It was a 600-pound structure, hit me in the head, folded me in half. It was snow. There was plenty of snow on the ground. It was evening, just like dusk. And I found myself pinned under there. When I tried to get out of it, I could not get out of it. And then I started to panic. I was like, what? Why can't I get out of here? Luckily, I had a cell phone on me, a flip phone.
Yeah.
And I called my neighbor, who did not answer. I called, then I said, well, fine, I'll call 911. And when I called 911 and I was telling them where I was. I did have a friend at the time who would, I would let them come and light fires to my forest because they were firemen, and they would practice putting, like, using their new equipment to put out a brush fire, because I lived in a very remote place. Mm-hmm. And so my first thought was like, nobody's ever going to find me. How are they going to find me? And luckily I had made that connection already with the firemen in town that they knew where I was and heard it on the scanner from the 911 call. And some of them came up already, you know, by themselves, just, we're going to go there and wait for the police. They knew where I was. So they started to come to get me. But while I was by myself, before any of that, the 911 call for me started to just fade away. Mm-hmm. I just faded away from it. I wasn't speaking anymore, mm-hmm. but I know that they found my phone with the 911 call still active. Right. They stay on the phone with you. But what had happened to me was I saw a tiny piece of glitter from very far away. I was like, what's that sparkly thing? What is that? And it got closer to me. And I was like, that looks like a tunnel. And I was like, oh no, I'm dying. Uh-oh, right? I was like, oh no, this is how I die. And I could see just a little bit out of where I was crushed. Yeah. The snow was melting beneath me and my bones were breaking in my chest. My ribs are held together with scar tissue. Even now, if I cry or laugh too hard, they will pop, they will crack. Mm-hmm. And I still have, I don't have pain anymore in my back or my neck, mm-hmm. But I used to. It was chronic pain. Mm-hmm. What was so cool and interesting about the experience was that as I was looking out through this little window, I would call it, of what I could see, there was snow all around and the forest. And I saw these barefoot feet coming towards me. And the person was dressed like a Buddhist monk. And this Buddhist monk looked down and then he looked up to my left and he said to the person up to my left, she'll live. It's going to be okay. And then there was, for me, a moment where the spirit guide of me was saying, you need to come with me now through this tunnel. And I was like, didn't you hear the monk? He said, I'm going to live. So I don't want to go through the tunnel. Also, my child was only about 4 years old at the time and was inside my home. And my dogs were outside with me as well, trying to figure out ways to help me. I believe they were trying to dig me out, but it didn't really work. They couldn't really do the job. Mm-hmm. My spirit guide said to me, because I've been doing this work my whole life, said to me, you know, you can't help your child if you don't come with me. Like, if I stayed as a ghost, what can I do? I can't help them at all. Mm-hmm. I can't help anyone. And I know that. And I would be stuck, right? Mm-hmm. So it was very painful to go into the tunnel. Mm-hmm. For me, because I felt like I was betraying my family, leaving my child behind. And my spirit guide actually did me a solid and showed me my funeral. So this made everything so real to me that I was watching my funeral. I was angry at the pictures they had put out. Mm. I had never made a will at that point in my life. Mm. I didn't say what I'd wanted for my death. It was completely out of my mind that was even going to happen to me someday at that time. And so I do remember seeing my funeral and watching my child walk away holding the hand of their father. And I was up on a hill and I remember saying, hey, hey. And my child turned around and looked at me.
You okay? Are you all right?
Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, I know it's hard.
It was so powerful.
Was it so vivid? Was it so real?
Like, it was so real. Like, yeah. I was actually experiencing it. So yeah. My guide made it so real. So I would believe that I was dead.
Yeah.
So when I was shown that, I said, okay, I'll go with you. I understand.
Yeah.
And I went through the tunnel.
Yeah.
And once I arrived on the other side, there seemed to be a lot of commotion.
Hmm.
I was taken to a place where I was reviewing not just my current lifetime, but every lifetime I had ever been.
You hear that,
and
right?
So, yeah. And so my spirit guides would stop me at a certain point and say, what could you have done differently here? Is that the best choice you could have made? And it was every lifetime. So I have knowledge now of who I was from the very beginning, all the way until this lifetime.
Mm.
So there seemed to be a moment then where me and my main guide were kind of like waiting in the hallway, like waiting for the principal's office kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there was a decision that needed to be made whether my body was viable to continue my mission.
Right.
And it was decided that I would continue my mission, but for now I was going to be taken to another place since I'd done all of my life reviews. I'd come to terms with what my karma is. And I was taken to a place as actually in the stars in the constellation Pegasus. I found myself being the intelligent gravity that holds the star cluster Stephan's Quintet together.
Very interesting stuff. Let's now head on over to part 2.